Thank you very much, Professor Dr. Lucknow, for your kind introduction, and I particularly want to thank you for this great opportunity for me to be able to be here for 6 months to work on this very interesting topic. I mostly work on 20th century and now 21st century fiction, and so what do I know about prognostication and fate? But a lot of time I feel like prognostication or divination is very similar to literature narrative, that you have random incidents of episode that you try to put together to make it a cohesive a narrative. So, this opportunity to offer me to think about a lot of different issues that I have never ventured into, and so I truly appreciate that and enjoy very much. Now, I start from March, and this is really the middle point of my tenure here, and so I was telling Esther Maria, it's too early. I haven't really figured out what exactly where I'm going to. So today I try to present something, perhaps a little bit schizophrenic. That is the first part. I kind of work toward that. And the second part, I try to bring my own discipline, which is a colonial literature, into this issue. And it's still kind of trying to merge together. And so it's a little bit shaky and probably full of a lot of holes. And I would really appreciate later comments that help me fill up those holes. So more than any other concept, the idea of fate seemed to be existed in old cultures. As a conceptual framework, its near universality is not in doubt, but the myriad various avenues for reading fate determine its meaning and implications, and attempt to figure, to fight against and change it culturally situated. I'm fascinated by how this universal element of civilization fit into diverse specific social and historical situations. For example, I was very interested in why astrology, yesterday Petra gave this wonderful talk, why it is so important in some culture, but not necessarily so in East Asia per se, where else geomancy is very important, but not necessary in other culture. So is this kind of thing that lead me to kind of want to ask several questions. Why, from a modern perspective, and the modern era ushered in different attitude toward fate and freedom. If so, what fundamentally changed? How did this change occur? Was the change sudden or gradual? What was at stake in this change, and what conflicts arose in this implementation? Were the new beliefs that arose equally local or more universal in character? Could new ideas about fate be transplanted to a new region or cultural milieu? So these are kind of my basic question that I'm trying to ask from this project. So today in my presentation, I would like to explore some of these issues, limit the scope of investigation to East Asia. I will first lay out this historical definition in a specific Japanese context, and then discuss its transformation in early 20th century. And finally, this is the second part, I will try to use some of the short stories written both by the Japanese writer and the native, Taiwanese colonial writer, to reveal some of the inherent conflict that one sees in this period of transition. So first, of course, when you deal with Japanese modernity, you first always have to come through this translation of terminology and concept and cultural, different cultural things. And so there is a considerable body of research on the early Meiji translation and coinage of new terms for some key Western concepts such as religion, society, nature, and so on, these kind of large, big, fundamental concept. And I recall that Natasha's talk gave us a very detailed and very nuanced way of thinking about these terminology and the concept, how they map on each other. And so I'm just going to go through this very quickly, just kind of give a quick examination. So for example, like for example, like this terminology, science, 科学, is original is actually taken from Chinese sources. Of course, is from the examination system, 科举之学. And then in the Tokugawa, late Tokugawa, early Meiji period, he used to refer to different discipline of knowledge. And then it only in 1878 he used, come to use as a kind of translation term for science and technology. And so we see a lot of these kind of transformation, even a very simple kind of a material object like a soap, it will first translate into katakana represent the sound shabon, sabon, shabon, and then eventually find a Chinese term to kind of represent it. So they are not just single one process, but rather a kind of a layering of different process. So what does Meiji lexical translation tell us? I think it tells us that a new lexicon was developed to represent a new foreign concept. And second, it demonstrates how it is possible for new meanings to become associated with old lexical items through redefinition or reinterpretation. That is like a religion, shukyo, is taking from old words and recombination into represent a modern concept of organized religion in the Christian Christianity sense. So these are the third. It reminds us about the conceptual gaps that exist between different cultures, revealing that our cognitive map is not a universal atlas that can be used to navigate all human experience. For example, a Japanese intellectual has a great difficulty to translate the word devil. And so they were trying to figure out how to represent devil. And the first thing they really actually go is to go for the traditional concept of this very monster kind of character, or magical, I should not say, magical character called Tengu, literally means the heavenly storm. And this is a kind of trickster character figure like that in mythology, in local legend, that will either play trick on you, play magic. They are famous now as adopting little kids. Child missing a lot of time, they would say it was adopted by Tengu. And so in early days, that is kind of very early stage. This is a much later transformation. You can see that it's famous for this big nose, or sometimes has the wings. So you can see sometimes it's hard to find a one-to-one correlation in that sense. So this knowledge gap, the Tengu translation, I look at that as a knowledge gap. That is, the new concept does not have an indigenous equivalent word. Even through Chinese, you cannot find the equivalent. That knowledge gap is something I like to kind of come back to explore later in my later part. So this fate, wunmei, in Japanese, and in Chinese, reverse, ming yun, this. So in the pre-modern period, that is before Meiji Restoration, 1868, you rarely see them used as a compound. Yun, fortune, luck, and ming is prevalent to all literature and historical writing, but you never rarely see them. I'm not saying you never, but I do find some old example, generally they are used separate. And this is fei, this wunmei, was one of these rare terms that was newly coined to represent a concept that was both foreign and indigenous simultaneously. However, being conceptually and lexically aligned does not mean that the term wunmei in modern usage is a mere continuation of the traditional one, and there are no disjuncture between the pre-modern concept and its modern manifestation. Okay. So in pre-modern Japanese literature is most of my sources come from. Then the term wun, luck, fate are mostly used separately. And I want to talk about, for example, like A religious understanding of fate is often invoked in classical literature, and in Japanese case, religion at the time was predominantly Buddhist Buddhism. Take the two, you have seen also the combination of using the variants of expression refer to this idea of fate, and this is kind of more religious usage. I also and then all the way through modern time, you can see that it applies to more secular patients about religion, about time, about the company. You know, in Western cooperation with industry, the fate is simply the capability of the CEO. But I would like to use some earlier literature example to kind of show, to give an idea about before a Meiji period, what kind of a conceptual faith it is. And I'm just gonna take the most big monumental work to give you a very kind of skeletal outline. So take, for example, the most prominent narrative from the classical period, the Tale of Genji. The Tale of Genji is known for evoking a sense of pathos. This idea, mono no aware, I don't know how to translate, so I find all the possible translation here, because nobody know how to translate mono no aware. But I think a gentle sadness or wishfulness at the passing of things, that you notice that things you move by that thing is monono aware. So it is a very kind of major aesthetic concept permeate throughout that particular period, particularly in the literary work. For example, like another one is medieval 13th century narrative. It's kind of like two treasure of classical Japanese literature. One is the Tale of Genji, the other one is the Tale of Heike, a military tale that are very famous for first passage, the beginning of this monumental narrative. Usually, I kind of call it this, there's a lute, and usually this narrative is particularly performed accompanied by a lute, a musician, and they were, so the most famous part, so I'm sure like a lot of Japanese high school students memorized chapter one, in particular these passages. The cyclical nature of human fate, that is, what go up must come down, what go up must come down. And so so character in this masterpiece ultimately yield to their fates. If they success, they bound to fail too. And so they yield to their fates. And like the tragic hero in the Greek tragedy, they reinforce the persistent determinism of fate. But in this context, in the Japanese context, yielding to fate is not considered a failure, but it rather accorded a certain degree of empathy and understanding. So Ivan Morris actually has a book called The Nobility of Failure, The Tragic Heroes in the History of Japan. In this book, he traces like six a hero, like historical hero figure from the very early on, like first century Yamato Takeru to 19th century Saigo Takamori. And these are all kind of hero that has a very tragic ending or commit suicide, a lot of them. And so the book is about their story. And so in general, their final self-destructive, destructive act receive as much attention as their act of heroism and actually enhance their status in the eyes of many of their fellow citizens. So there is an expression in Japan called a hōgambiki, meaning that you actually sympathize with the loser, the tragic hero, and rooting for the underdog. That is very kind of a prominent sentiment in Japan. It's kind of, kind of echoing what I call Evan Moore is trying to capture this asceticism of the failed. Like failure is not just or nothing, but in a sense, gallantly fighting on despite foreseeable defeat, of course, in the historical hindsight, took the utilitarian motif, that is winning, success, out of this mix, and therefore these heroes are to be recommended both for their fatal flaw and their courage in the face of defeat. This asceticism of the failed remains a theme for theater and literature into the early modern period, which is 17th century to mid-19th century. In the popular music, popular kabuki play, puppet play, joji play, and all these narratives. And one example is this dramatist, Chikamatsu no Draimo, who has a whole body of work focused on this idea of double suicide play, very, very popular. So usually it's a hero, usually coming from lower class status, they fall in love with an expensive courtesan and they could not get married, so in a sense, they commit double suicide. In that sense, they hope that by their death, they can be reborn next life to be together. So it's a kind of a very popular thing that you have made into modern films. So Chikamatsu, the dramatist, created a category of hero who belong to the lower status, that is merchant class. In this particular period, there are four classes of samurai, farmers, the second class, and the third class is the artisan, craftsperson, and the fourth class is merchants, because they only deal with money. And so these four classes, again, I'm talking about that kind of very strictly feudal society, but I'm definitely not trying to say nobody can rise above their rank in a general sense. So it's very clearly delineated, this hierarchical order. So he created this thing and fall in love, and then so in a sense, I read that this suicide was ritualized, originally and codified as an honorable act for the samurai class in the Tokugawa period, and that same sentiment gradually trickled down to the merchant class, as we see in this one. So also, if you push a little further to the 19th century modern literature, when I teach Japanese modern literature, students always say, "Why do Japanese writers like to commit suicide?" And indeed, there are a lot from Meiji writers like Kitamura Tōkoku, Akutagawa Ryūnosuke, Kawabata Yasunari, all the very openly and public performed, Mishima Yukio, most recently, I think, is this very famous literary critical, Eto Jun, in 2006. So all this series of suicide, I think, unlike the countries dominated by Christian value, these writers were not scorn as irresponsible or rash, but rather mourn and revere for their personal sacrifice for art's sake. Okay, so this reader audience identification with these larger than life hero may have to do with a deep rooted fatalism embedded in the collective psyche of Japanese people. In this sense, the hero do not have to succeed because, like all of us, they too cannot fight against the indomitable course of fate. And thus, at least the final ritualistic act of self-negation of suicide can be seen as a last act of defiance, controlling one's own fate before the larger outside forces destroy oneself. So now I want to talk about, before the mid-19th century. So I now move a little bit into what we call the modern period. So the compound Wunmei, the word fate would gain popularity in Meiji period as a translation for this newly imported term of fate. Just a quick search of a Meiji literature database, you find all sorts of stories, essays, all have these fate, so the modern discourse of fate as demonstrated in the abundance of these fiction and essays that deal with fate marks a certain departure from the previous view in two aspects, I think. And these are like, first, fate came to be seen as an independent force unrelated to the Buddhist notion of karma. Second, the modern individual was seen as capable of intervening in the working of fate. So I will try to kind of explain more in what do I mean by intervention. The intervention, the insertion of modern human being, I would like just show you a couple of these kind of buzzword that you see a lot in Meiji writing. The insertion of the modern human subjectivity into this new construction of the discourse of fate has to do with, I think, several factors. And the first is the emergence of the individual, jiga, kojin, zi-wo, ge-ren, and the idea of equality. So this transformation has to do with the newly emerging conscious of the self. And when I work on Meiji, early Meiji literature, a lot of times the awakening of self is really the major theme of that period. You know, like people realize that they are themselves, and they not they have kind of being delinked from a much larger kind of family network. So this is a ubiquitous theme in fictional and non-fictional writing in the turn of the 20th century. The newly formed self marked a modern subjectivity that is liberated from the feudalistic, when we talk about four-class society, and instead all people were now considered equal, the four people, 四民, 市民黑多. And so this is the first thing, is the kind of liberation of the self. Secondly, imported concept of liberty and right. And then again, we see a lot of kind of new points and try to designate this idea of freedom, right, and so on and so forth. I would like to point out this one I find very interesting is independence first was translated into jishu, jiyu. And ji is self. Shu actually is a master. So it's master of oneself and jiyu is freedom. But when it grows, my PowerPoint did not grow it on top. But usually in the Meiji text, you see it grows as hitori, standing by oneself in the sense. So this idea of self and right and freedom really kind of, I think, bring in a new dimension of how people think about themselves versus the fate. However, this new self, the jiga, is a free agent who has to fend for himself and his immediate family without the protection or benefit of an extended family network. A commonly seen slogan of the time, I think I will put it up here, a very famous slogan in Meiji period is called Nishin Shusei. Establish yourself and make a name of yourself in this world. It's a very kind of popular, prominent idea, particularly for young men. You know, you young men, you need to go far, go north, go west to establish yourself, Nishin Shusei. Okay, and so this is what I see is this idea is like, yeah, liberated one, but then on the other hand, also lonely one and scary. And this is a theme that you see in modern literature a lot, like even Shamu Shishi, Natsume Soseki, all these people deal with this issue. So this ideology or slogan reflected on one hand that members of aristocratic lineage, samurai shizoku, which the whole system abolished in 1869, lost their stipend. They don't have no more money from the shogunate, no salary. Lost their stipend and their offspring were no longer guaranteed privileged position. And on the other hand, the newly equalized citizens from lower class were now free to pursue their own success. So you see loser and not less loser. So in 1870, young people pondered the newly won freedom with both purpose, optimism, and perplexity. It's not, they also need to figure out, then how do I go about to do this? Among the best-selling books at the time were translation of Samuel Smiles' Self-Help. And in Japan, it translated into, again, taking this bishin and bishi, the Western story on how one established oneself, or one determined one's own will, basically.
And also another one is the Orient, also Orient Swept Martyrs, Pushing Through the Crowd.
And this book was actually used, they both used as a textbook designated by the Meiji government. I think this one is used as an English textbook. People learn to read English through pushing ahead, pushing to the front. So these these are stories that about recall like 300 examples of how people, industrialists, inventors, entrepreneurs, their success story, and so has a great impact on that. And this self-help also promote this what a historian Earl Kimmel say. Create a new middle class and promote a kind of ethical core for a new elite class. And so basically it's kind of promoting science, producer of goods, technician, and advocate the Protestant work ethic, which focus on perseverance, scientific method, industrialness, self-reliance, individual initiative, and so forth. But one interesting, if you look at this book, the first chapter really is titled Self-Help, National and Individual. So it is the next step I want to talk about is kind of expanding not just to an individual, but to a larger national project. Although Samuel Smiles' enlightened philosophy of self-help was mainly geared toward improving one's economic fortune and professional advancement for elite bureaucratic class, it has a broad appeal and its influence could be felt across all social strata. It was so popular, so almost a million copy, and all the people line up at night try to get a copy. So it's that popular. And very interesting is this book actually are still being read in Japan. Even to this day, I actually find out that the latest translation was done in 2001. And it's actually changed from this title, Pushing to the Front, it's a little bit aggressive, to something like All Is That Modern. Interesting. And the advertisements say, after 100 years, it still works. So what I'm trying to kind of put forth is that kind of this sense of optimistic, the optimist self-empowerment permeated the Meiji society. And so this is kind of a glimpse. In fact, I now want to say, how does this glimpse of optimism got crashed? Very soon, so you see a glimpse of that. So I want to talk about this, the paradox of Meiji individualism, the idea. So in one way, you have this modernization, westernization of the of social reform, technology, and science advances. But on the other hand, the whole system is sustained through restored imperial system. We know that before 1868, the emperor actually was not particular, doesn't have the actual power. And so it's kind of new, but it also old, in some sense, restored one of the oldest kind of political system like that. And so also this idea of religion at this juncture of time being nationalized. So you have these kind of Meiji Constitution set up, but however, it also has certain other things that I now will talk about. So support for the Meiji Restoration as a reform movement was prompted by the geopolitical condition in the 19th century and early 20th century in Asia. As when Japan looked at its neighbor, it saw China weakened by the Western colonial powers and ceding its territorial sovereignty to like France, Britain, and Germany, and Korea was much lusted after by the Russians. So Great Britain ruled over India, Spain over Philippines, and the French in Vietnam, and so forth. Japan was no exception, with the Commodore Perry's black sheep, Kurobune, on his doorstep. Japan's experienced its biggest external crisis since the Mongol invasion of the 13th century. Japan responded to this outside force by taking its fate into its own hands through rapid modernization, mimicking the Western powers. The restoration of the emperor system, returning sovereignty power to the political center, was a crucial step in reorienting Japan's trajectory. So perhaps the biggest irony we find in the story of Japan's modernization was the conflict of newly emerging self and the collective, and this time not the oppressive feudal family or class system, but the burgeoning modern nation state represented by the restoration of one of the oldest imperial families. So in a sense, Japanese people were released from feudal class society into a modern constitutional monarchy, but the nascent sense of the self was soon engulfed and submerged in the this idea of national polity, kokutai, a little more about that, and then was incorporated into the collectivity surrounding the emperor again. So the Meiji idea of a nation polity or kokutai was, the nation become a biological entity, organism, or family unit, with the emperor as the head of the family and everybody else as the subordinate to that. With this new kind of corporeal metaphor, an individual's assumption of responsibility for his or her own fate was mapped onto this larger canvas of the fate of the nation. This is why I try to see it emerging of that. Of course, this idea of kokutai, a lot of scholars do research on that. Probably, maybe can make a good connection with this vitalism and things like that. But nowadays, the historian pretty much look at that as a kind of fascist kind of ideology. But this, what I'm trying to say is kind of emerging self pretty soon kind of grows onto this much larger national fate, issue of national fate. So here I like to pause and ask, what is the relationship of individual to the nation when it comes to the fate and freedom? Is it metaphorical, parallel, interchangeable, complementary, or disparate? And so in a sense, this kokutai system that valorized the collective fate of the nation over the fate of any single individual, with a communal interest overriding that of the individual. It is this absolute and totalizing mode of operand that accelerated Japan to quickly rid itself of the baggage of the tradition and move up the rank with the most advanced Western powers of the time. And through social evolution and progressivism, which many public intellectuals deem as the fate of Japan's path to survival and eventual dominance in East Asia, a new discourse on the nation's fate emerged. As the new outlook on fate taking hold, the traditional folk belief, or what we call the superstitions, were being marginalized further and further. So on the political front, victory in two external wars, the Sino-Japanese War and the Russo-Japanese War, greatly boost the confidence of Japanese and propel the country to enter the first war from the enter the first world order from the half civilized third world order status. So in other words, Japan has arrived, has a shusei, you know, has come as a nation, and its future seemed bright, and the fate of the nation could only be go up and up. So to predict the future, so here I'm gonna kind of transition to the second part, which I still try to work through a lot of kinks. So to predict the future is to read the past, you know, as we, in a lot of our colloquium, we talk about that issue. And only the known can help decipher the unknown. So when the fate of all people was linked to one divine one, that is the emperor, modern Japan can hardly be said to have been a secular society in that sense. So here lies the second irony of the modernization of Japan, that a scientifically inclined modern state was also officially a divine nation. It was under the divine protection of their emperor that the soldier went to fight and the citizen endured the hardship of warfare. So colonial subjects were incorporated as part of the sacred body of the state, and this is kind of, I'd like to turn and where to kind of expand it outside of Japan, you know, in terms of that transition, to see how does that idea applied to other part of Asia. So here, I would like to turn to the examination of the epistemological gap between Japan and its colony, and here I use Taiwan, of course, I'm sure similar research we can do on various locations. I use Taiwan because I'm more familiar with it. So I would like to look specifically at their attitude toward tradition belief. And I would do so by looking at several stories by Japanese writer and by native Taiwanese writer. So hopefully we can see how the past and the future will read much differently during the half century when Taiwan was ruled by the Japanese colonial authority. And I will then return to my previous question. Can local belief and practice transcend cultural and national boundaries? When we talk about seeing the future, we are talking about whose future are we seeing exactly. So the first story I would like to if I have time, come back to this. I just kind of want to remind ourselves that we always think of Meiji as a kind of modern state and everything is modern Western. But in fact, it's, you know, these kind of folk practices are still very much prevalent. And in Japan, of course, taking a lot of Chinese way of the nation and domestication, but also kind of developing that this idea of modern and superstition kind of dichotomy or binary schema is perhaps need to be kind of rethink a little bit. And this is, particularly this project made me rethink that, you know, a little bit. But we can get back to that. So the story one I would talk about is called, I'm actually way over time, so I'm just gonna be very quickly talk about this. This story is about written by a Japanese author, and it's from a Japanese perspective. A Japanese newspaper reporter stationed in Taiwan, and he's an investigator, reporter. He make friends with a native young man, intellectual. So they one day they go out to take a walk, and they, when they go out to take a walk, they come to this old house, and people say, oh, that's a, you know. So they went into this house, and they hear a voice, a woman's voice. And so they were so afraid, they run out. And the neighbor, old lady, said, oh, that's a haunted house. Everybody knows it's haunted. It's a ghost in there, a female ghost in there. And so there you kind of ensue a conversation between the two. That is the native people say, whoa, a ghost. And then the Japanese modernist reporter, journalist, of course, say, there's no ghost. I mean, you know, what? How can you believe such a silly thing? There's no ghost. And the young guy said, but not just me heard it. Everybody heard it, this ghost. So there's a kind of what I call kind of epistemological. And then they continue to discuss this thing. And it's a kind of ruined house. And so this Japanese, oh, everything is gone. And the Taiwanese say, everything is gone, the building is gone, everything's, but does that mean it's really gone, it's lost? So they kind of a discussion about a parish lost, and so the Japanese say, well, it's gone, you know, don't look back, just move forward. And the Chinese keep saying, but you know, the ruin perhaps does not necessarily mean it's completely terrible, gone. Maybe there's something that can never be revived. So there's an argument between this, it's a very long story, it's a novel, I took all these materials in to kind of demonstrate how does one read other people's present and future if one does not share the past together. And so that is kind of one dilemma. The other one, second story, I'm just going to skip it, is Lü He Ruo's called Geomancy, Feng Shui. And this is a practice about this idea of burial. And it's a practice that seen in Taiwan, in Fujian, Okinawa, and some people say in Vietnam. So it is basically when your parent, you bury your parent, you after 9 years, according to the short story, I know Li Fengmao has an article saying it should be 7 years after the burial, but I will take the author's 9 years. And then after that, you pick up your parents, you wash the bone clean, and then you put them in this golden jar and rebury them. That is the really final ritualistic aspect of the burial process, by reburial in the proper way. That is the thing. So it's a story about the two brothers, one is more modern, one is more try to kind of deal with this issue, and the conflict come from that. I don't have time to go into that. But what I want to kind of mention is the shock the Japanese critic and other author have toward this piece. You say, what a barbaric way. I mean, what's wrong with these people that they dig up a tomb and collect this thing? You know, that's why we need to kind of really, really fast to modernize this island, because this practice is so barbaric. So this has to do with a very complex Japanese policy of kind of regulating religion, regulating how people practice this kind of thing. And so Japan, of course, one thing they noticed is Taiwanese spend too much money the funeral. So they want to pare it down, they want to, according to, and one thing I wanted to point out is that it's not just Okinawa, it's just not Taiwan, Okinawa is doing that too. And this is actually ingrained from Commodore Perry's diary. They talk about how Okinawa and these type of practice too. All these things, you know, so what I'm trying to say is like this idea of feng shui, yinzai is kind of for tomb site, yangzai is for house, village, and city planning. And so in Japan, it's not that Japan does not practice feng shui, but they focus mostly on living, on the living, you know, architecture, where else the native practice is very much focused on that. And so what I read that as not as barbaric as the Japanese critic attacking this piece, but rather it has a certain cultural meaning for the native people when they practice that, because it's precisely, it has to do with the future, the prosperity of the next generation. So it's very important that you have a good spot that is tied into with the cosmic force that can have a flow of proper flow of qi that will nourish the parents' body, that will impact on positively on the children. So I saw that kind of very important connection that Ryu Hero tried to reveal in this piece. Where else, of course, the critic is not Japanese too. They also, because they are from a Buddhistic crematory funeral practice, that they do not see that connection. And so if the first story I use as a kind of time, that history, how do one read this jack disruptor of history in terms of temporality being disrupted? This one I use it as kind of spatial thing that is locality. How do we do that? So I'm really much way over time, so I'm not gonna come to a very, very tentative conclusion, and that is, I want to kind of, like I say, reframe this idea of modern and superstition. And maybe thinking about, it's not because Japan is not superstition. I think we want to rethink this issue of not just kind of, when we think about the issue, not just East-West dichotomy. I want to kind of pay attention to variants of even practice within East Asia, so-called Asian shared culture. Secondly, I want to kind of get out this framework of science, superstition, modern and pre-modern, and maybe and this is a pitfall that people who do colonial study always say, and I have to admit sometimes I kind of do modern and things like that. But I want to kind of rather talk about this cultural system, that incompatibility of cultural system or selectivity of a certain cultural system that just does not kind of jive with each other. And so the pre-Meiji, I think there's more I would like to do about this, but I think pre-Meiji cyclical view of the fate of individual and the state transfigured into a kind of linear vision with its future foretold. And the dynamic intertwine of the two of fate of these what I try to now try to develop is to see using this framework to answer a question that a lot of people who do colonial study, particularly Japanese colonists, ask, why did they not see the ending coming? You know, like, or the factor. And so why would Japan, even at 1943, at least, the whole public discourse is still very optimistic and gung-ho. In one sense, that is the information control, or in one sense is there's a certain blind spot in their idea of seeing the future. So it's not a real conclusion, but just kind of lay out these two very disjuncture part. And thank you for your patience, and sorry for the overtime.